The baby sun goes. Okay, this is May 20th, 2013, Buckingham Manor in London.
No,
I wouldn't mind getting all introduced to everybody. I don't know all the little ones.
Maybe we'll do the what we normally do.
I'll
go around and say,
"Hi, Kaylee, nice to see you."
Hi, Kaylee.
I didn't bring my knife with me. I have to go back to the room to get it if we're going to do open surgery. Whatever you like.
Can you tell us how to deal with terrible twos?
Why don't we just have an open Q&A? Yes. All right? All right? Okay, we'll do that.
Oh, we had your question. Yeah. Sorry,
we had really good. We had some questions.
Yeah. What's that thing?
Yeah.
Oh, it was about routine. I had a question about routine and how was your routine with a 0 to 3 year old, like.
If I told you what my routine was, you would think I was a complete fanatic. You sure you want to hear it?
Yeah.
You'll just walk. You'll never ask me to speak to you guys again. That'll be the.
They go for Mangala.
Oh yeah.
Like
that was good times, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, my first child was born at 4:30 in the morning. We were Mangalore to the next day. And my second child was born at 6:30 at night, and I went down the lift to Mangalore to the next day. With my third child, we lived a half an hour drive from the temple, so he was 3 days old before we went to Mangalore.
Oh.
What about the next day? Elevating.
So we lived on the 9th floor. Those who live like on the 5th floor.
But how did your child sleep, or
it was? It was interesting that what I discovered was that if you wake your kid up at a certain time, if you do something in a certain time every day, if you're regulated, that your child naturally becomes regulated, and they naturally become regulated very quickly. Just naturally and quickly, and then your life is so much easier than people who structure their schedule around their child's schedule. I didn't do that intentionally. In other words, I didn't have a schedule thinking from a material perspective, well, that's going to regulate my child and my life will be easier. I was just in the everybody has to go to Mangalarti frame. So what I discovered that was by doing that, I got all these side benefits. And again, I didn't even understand that was what was happening for a while. It was. You have to remember, in those days in ISKCON, there were no elders. Prabhupada was the only elder by any measurement of elderliness, spiritual age, or just material experience. We had all rejected our parents. Your parents were all just karmis, meat eating karmis that you weren't supposed to listen to. So the only contact you were supposed to have with your parents was to give them prasad and tell them to surrender to Krishna. So you're going to take any advice from them. So as a result, we didn't really have any kind, and you weren't supposed to read any books other than the Prabhupada's books. Even for something for a practical purpose, so it left us really just, we made a lot of mistakes. Let's put it that way, kindly. But anyway, that ended up to be a very good thing to do. And I've noticed people who say, "Well, my kid isn't regulated. I'm going to wait till my kid gets regulated, and then I'll be regulated." And they're still waiting. The kid's 3 or 4 years old, and their eyes are still a mess. And I mean, I was at a place recently where they were quoting some sannyasi who's never had children, which I always think is interesting to quote somebody who's never had children, saying that until the kid's 5, you should let them eat and sleep whenever they want. And I'm like,
oh.
If somebody wants to do that, okay, fine. But to say that everybody has to do that, is some kind of a spiritual principle. And if you don't do that, your kid's going to be wacky. It's really... Oh, my goodness. I never would have had more than one kid, and I probably would have jumped out a window or something. But anyway, what I discovered was, you know, of course, the first, when they're a tiny little newborn, they don't necessarily wake up. But when you're doing the same thing at the same time every day, then the kid starts getting into a routine. They just do it, you know, it just happens. You're picking up the child and you're changing their nappy, and then they want a nurse, and then you're going somewhere. And so all three of my kids ended up on exactly the same schedule. So they would all, you know, after a while they would get up spontaneously at about 3:30, and then they'd want a nurse perform on Galarti, and then I'd nurse them after Chelsea Artique, and then they'd go to sleep. So then I would have my Japa time when they were sleeping. And almost always they would sleep through Japa, and then reading the DVDs would wake them up. You know, they're in the, this was in the, with my first child, we were allowed to be in the temple room. You know, then when some former sannyasis came and said women shouldn't be in the temple room for Japa, they should stand in the back during kirtan, and they shouldn't offer arti when there's men in the temple room, and they shouldn't offer dandavats and all these sort of things that they put on us. But anyway, then it was a lot harder. But when we were in the temple room, and I would have my kids sleeping between my husband and myself, you know, so if he did wake up, one of us could take care of them, and greeting the deities would naturally wake them up. And then once I wasn't allowed to chant japa in the temple room, I'd bring my kid back in for deity greeting, and again, that would naturally wake them up. And then sometime after that, they'd want to nurse again. Then they'd be up for class, which meant that I'd have to listen in another room on a speaker, or I'd have to get it recorded and listen later. And then they'd stay up until breakfast. And then after breakfast, I would go home and nurse them again, and then they'd go to sleep, and they would take a nap, and I would take a nap. And then the afternoon was unscheduled. The afternoon was whatever. You know, each of them had an unscheduled afternoon. So sometimes they'd take another nap in the afternoon, sometimes not. And their nursing during the afternoon was more sporadic. And then they were going to bed like by 8 or 9 o'clock at night. So all three of my kids did that. And I don't think it was that I had three kids who naturally got on the same schedule genetically. They got on the same schedule because I was on the same schedule. And like if women go back to work after they have a baby, same kind of thing will happen. You know, if the woman is getting up at the same time and she's going to a job at the same time, then the child will naturally fall into a pattern that they just will. And they'll naturally sleep more at night and so forth and so on. I mean, of course, there's variation between kids. Some kids hardly sleep at all, and kind of some kids sleep a lot, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But because that happened, because I could pretty much tell you when my kids were going to eat and when they were going to sleep, I had a lot of side benefits. One was that if they were crying, I pretty much knew why they were crying. I mean, my oldest kid had colic, so he cried for 45 minutes a day inconsolably from 6 to 6:45. And then my husband would come back from the temple, you know, and I'm sitting in the rocking chair, and my baby's crying, and I'm crying, and I'm just like... I remember one time he opened the door, I looked at the scene, and he turned around and walked out. That made me cry even more. But pretty much I knew what was the matter, because I had a routine. And the other thing is that I could get things done. I never had a problem chanting 16 rounds and 3 Gayatris with a baby. Never. And when people say, well, I have a kid, I can't get my rounds, I'm like, what? Huh? Why not? Frankly, I don't get it. It was never a problem. And generally, I had all my rounds done in the morning. And then I could get service done because they had pretty much a time that they would nap. So I already had all my japa done. And, you know, it wasn't every day. But when my first child was maybe 4 or 5 months old, I think the first baby takes you longer to figure out life and adjust to. And I started being a secretary for the BBT. They would send me letters in the mail. There was no internet then, you know, and I had a typewriter, and I would type the answers and mail them out. And some days I could work a half an hour, and some days I could work up to 4 hours, depending on how long he slept and what was going on. And then I went to the evening program also at the temple. And, I mean, with my first baby, I had time to read Prabhupada's books 4 to 6 hours a day. In addition to going to the whole morning program and the whole program. And when I wasn't reading, I was listening to recordings. So I was listening to recordings 3 or 4 hours a day.
Did you
say
your housework
and cooking? No, definitely not. I had a Bhagavatam there next to my rocking chair. Whenever I would nursing, I'd read Bhagavatam. And, you know, whenever I had to do housework or stuff, I'd listen to it. We're recording for him. I tried to walk around and hold him. Now, what's really sad about that whole time is there was a lot of preaching in ISKCON then against women, and which translated to against household men, against children. So it was heavy, heavy. It was very heavy. And we're still suffering from that. There's still fallout in our movement from those years. And it was very, very heavy against women and against householders and against children. And the only people doing anything worthwhile were the book distributors. So during that time, I felt as if my life was wasted and as if I was not doing any service and I was just an illusion. Even though I was going the whole morning program, the whole evening program, you know, typing letters to the BBT, reading Robert's books 4 to 6 hours a day and taking notes. I had a whole little file case with notes and listening to lectures 3 or 4 hours a day. But I just felt like I was wasting my life. I mean, now I see that people will spend money and save up for years to go to India to do that. So I did that for about 1.5 years. And the main reason I was able to do that is that the temple had this policy of you couldn't do any service when you had a baby because you were unclean. And I brought my baby to the temple, and I said, you know, I can put him to sleep in this room and do something. And I had a sign on the door, please don't come in, baby sleeping. Of course, people would wake him up. And so I wasn't allowed to do any temple service, and because of that, I could spend all my time studying. Yeah, now with my second baby, I was started to do regular service when she was 1 month old. Part of that was just I was more together because I knew more of what I was doing, and part of that was that she was the perfect baby. So if you wrote out a list of what would be a perfect baby, she never, ever, ever cried. Never. She didn't cry when she was born. She didn't cry when she was hungry. When she was hungry, she'd go. I mean, if you let her go for 20 or 30 minutes, then she would cry. But we lived in the temple, and the devotees would say, does your baby ever cry? And she would nurse every 3 hours for 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Every 3 hours for 5 minutes. I would have to switch her after 2 minutes, otherwise I'd get engorged on myself. And so she would just be happy in a little infancy or, you know, with her older brother to show her books or something. She was very easily happy. She was happy with someone else watching her. She was just like, thank God she wasn't my first one. Because if she was my first one, I would have thought I was a perfect mother. And I would have thought it was me. You know, but so I was able to do a lot of service very early with her. And with my third baby, I started running the nursery school again, I think when he was 2 months old.
What's the age difference between them?
4 and 3. 4 years between the first two and 3 between the second.
So, what did you cook? When did you have time to cook?
Well, with the first baby, I didn't cook because cooking was Maya.
Cooking was Maya?
Yeah, cooking was Maya. Oh. Well, household life was Maya, you see. So to have a house and to have a baby and to have a kitchen was all Maya. You were just supposed to, you know, all live communally. But when I did start to cook, well, with my second baby, I not only cooked for ourselves, I was the official guru cook. So I cooked for all the gurus. I cooked all our chapatis and such. We never bought prepared or semi-prepared. The only thing I ever bought was like yogurt and cream cheese or something like that. I usually made my own ghee. Sometimes I'd make my own yogurt. There was one point where what I did when I was running the nursery school, well, we'd eat breakfast at the temple, and then I'd come home from the temple, I would measure out all the rice, and all the, you know, I'd set it up, I'd cut all the vegetables, I'd make the chapati dough and cover it, and I would set up the doll and boil it for 2 minutes and then cover it and leave it. And then my kid would take a nap and I would take a nap. So that would take like 20, 30 minutes to set
it
up.
You did that straight after breakfast.
Right after I got back from the temple, I would take like 20 minutes to set that up. And then I would take a nap. Then actually I was cooking for the whole nursery school, so I was cooking for like 15 kids plus my family. So I'd set that up and then I would take a nap. And then I'd get up from the nap and I could just finish it in 20, 30 minutes. So then you didn't need to have the kid entertained for so long, and then the nursery kids would come. And once I started teaching Gurukul, I stopped cooking. I couldn't do that. I wasn't able to teach full-time and cook. So we hired somebody to cook for the school, and they also cooked for our family. So it was varied. I had times as a grahasta when I didn't cook at all because I was cooking for her husband, which was Maya. It depended, you know, different times in ISKCON history. It was Maya to cook at home or it was Maya to eat at the temple, you know, it depends on what the fashion was at the time. And there were times that I did all of our cooking. I'd say mostly we would eat breakfast at the temple. So it would be unusual that I would make breakfast. But there were many years that I cooked lunch. I mean, also when you make dal rice, chapati, and sabji every day, it's pretty easy. And my husband just wanted dal rice, chapatis, and sabji. So. Well, that was what they knew. They didn't know anything else. So that was... Well, I made pasta sometimes. I made pasta like if we went out shopping and we got back really late because we wouldn't eat anything outside. I wouldn't buy anything outside for them. So, you know, we'd get back late and everybody's starving. So then you just make pasta. Or those deep fried things, those like potato swirly things you get at the Indian stores. They're like the different colors.
Oh, yeah.
Those little different rectangles. And you just throw them in the ghee and the whole
crispy thing.
Yeah, wok fills up with them immediately. Yeah. So if I was out shopping, we didn't get back till 7:30 at night and everybody was starving because we wouldn't buy food outside at all. So then I would make, you know, those little things would be like that. That you could make just in time to heat up ghee and some pasta. So they had things like that. But they consider that real, you know, that was a really special. But anyway, if you make dal rice, chapati, and sabji, all you're varying is what kind of beans, what kind of sabji, do I put some spices or nuts in the rice and stuff like that. It's, you know, then ekadasi is always a trip. It's always, you know, two or three times as long to cook on ekadasi because everything's vegetables, and so you've got to do so much cut up, especially if you're cooking for, you know, 14, 15 people.
And the
food
was very
ekadasi
as well.
Okay.
Everything you did, they did.
Yeah, me too. Again, I'm not sure if that is the best thing in the world. I would change some things if I were going to do it. I don't want to do it again. Thank you, Krishna. I don't want to take another life just to try to get it done right. But I would do some things differently. I would have more programs at home instead of going to the temple all the time. Mostly because the temple atmosphere was very anti-child. And so there was a lot of negative vibes in the temple.
Are there a lot of children that age as well when you...
Well, there were until they started putting all these restrictions on the women. Because the men could chant japa in the temple room, the women would get a second tier facility, and the women with children would get the third tier facility. So like in Detroit, first they gave us the bathroom for the women with children. There was a toilet sink room, and then there was kind of what you call like a lounge area. Yeah. Well, it wasn't the same room as the toilet. So there was a carpeted room. When you went into the toilet room, there was a carpeted room first, and then there was the toilet.
No.
But it was part of it. It had been a mansion, so that was where the ladies put on their makeup and fixed their gowns and that. So they gave us that room for Gopa. But then later they gave us the garage for Gopa.
No.
So it was very cold. There was no heat in there. I mean, later on, my husband and I paid to put heat in there, but there was no heat in there, and it wasn't very clean. The floor was tile. It was very cold. And, you know, I mean, when we first went there, my husband and I had asked if we could have the bowling alley, because it had been a mansion. Mm-hmm. So we asked if we could turn the bowling alley into a children's room, and the temple president said yes. we spent about 2 weeks, and I'm not sure how much money, cleaning it and fixing it up. And after we did that, the town president said, oh, what a nice room. Now we're going to use it for something else. We didn't use it at all. So it was kind of hard. And most of the women wouldn't keep coming under those conditions. So it was often just me or maybe one or two other people. And most people stopped bringing their kids. You know, and then we'd have to buy a cabinet and buy toys and keep it there and keep things for our kids.
Don't draw on the...
It was a little different.
Tanya, don't draw on the sofa. I can't draw on
the... Is there anything else you would have done differently? Just doing programs at home or...
Probably also to get together with other people outside the temple. I basically would have cut a lot of my dependence on the temple. And a lot of the concept that Krishna consciousness means going to a temple every day, I would have really cut that. Would have probably gone to a temple maybe 2 days a week.
2 days a week,
yeah, I wouldn't have done more than that.
You mean for the morning program?
Yeah. If I were to do it again, or if I would advise people, unless you have a very unusual temple. That's really family friendly and child friendly. But even then, I'd suggest 1 or 2 days a week at home or with other families.
Have sanghas with families.
Well, because most people, once they marry and have a family, are just not going to go to a temple every day for a whole bunch of reasons. One reason being that the program is from 4:30 to 9:30. And most people can't do that and have a life. Most people can't do that and have a job and go to school. I mean, in North Carolina, the whole program was over at 7:30, so that was a lot easier. And if you've trained your children and yourself that sadhana means a temple, then when you can't go to a temple, you may give up your sadhana, which we see a lot. The people, they can't go to a temple, and so they, you know, all of a sudden their sadhana is finished. Now I'd say, you know, train your children that they can be sadhana without being dependent on a temple.
It's okay.
And
you can put it down.
Mama thought I was taking it. Is that your mommy's?
Yes, it's mommy's.
Is that mommy's?
There's a baby.
The baby was going to get mommy's.
Mama's recording something. What is that?
We won't let the baby get it. We'll make sure the baby doesn't get it, okay? We'll watch it. I love your socks that look like shoes. That is so cool. Also, a lot of things at the temple just are not geared for children. And most of the people who give Bhagavatam classes, even when I had a gurukul and I was bringing kids to the temple, you know, I was bringing anywhere between 15 to 30 kids and having them sit in the Bhagavatam class, and the speakers would generally forget there were children. It was bizarre.
Were they quiet?
Oh, of course. But the speaker would just... You know, the way they would be speaking would be as if they're... And sometimes the kids were one-third of the audience. And still, they would never address the children. They would use language and examples and that were just for adults. I mean, sometimes they'd say things like, so all of us have had sinful births, and I'd be like, what about these guys? Hello? It's like, I mean, sometimes it was... funny, like when Vichitaviriya was quoting from the Bible, and he said, so in the Bible it says you shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's ass. And one of the kids was Bhumadev's daughter. She turned to me and said, he said ass. That was really funny. But it was just evidence that they weren't thinking.
And listening.
Here's children. So that was frustrating. And I'd like to see, you know, I would do more programs at home with other families where discussing the Shastra would be fun instead of something boring you have to sit through because it's part of your school. So I see, you know, if you just have the kids sit through something that's boring. And now I finally kind of woke up to that and said, you know, a lot of these classes are going to be what to speak of to the children. And sometimes prasadam that wasn't at all suitable for the children, where they wouldn't want to eat it. And again, then it just gives the kids a sour feeling about Solomon and Krishna consciousness. Why I go to the temple and I listen to this boring class, and then I have to eat this food that I don't want to eat. And, you know, it ended up having some of the opposite effect to that which I would have desired. Well, we ended up, after a while, we ended up doing the program at home once a week. What we had in North Carolina for the families is we suggested at least an hour. So, like 20-20-20. The easiest thing to do with children is remove the possibility. So we recommended at least a 20-20-20, you know, japa, kirtan, and class. So it was all together an hour.
Fans are for paper. Where's the paper? Do you have a paper?
Something short and where they can also participate. You know, where the kids starting at a fairly young age can give a class.
What age?
7, 8. If you've trained them nicely. And where they can lead a kirtan. I mean, you're just home, you know? Where they can offer Tulsi RT. My granddaughter was helping me, actually helping me, truly, really, truly helping me with my Didi Puja from 1.5. So that's unusual, but so she was.
How are the standards with the kids, you know, for the DD?
Well, she had to take a shower, take a bath, but she took a bath in the morning anyway. Have clean clothes, she had to be potty trained. Well, I trained her. I mean, she started sitting on my lap while I was doing my puja from the time she was 1. I trained her.
So she's thinking that why you offering RT and
while I was bathing this in the DVD. Do that all the time. So by the time she was 1.5, she could already help me. By the time she was 3, she could do a lot of the puja herself. Sometimes, but not regularly. She was the only one who did it. Just one of my granddaughters. Just her. And it wasn't. It didn't come from me. Not at all. As soon as she'd see me doing any worship, she'd come over and stuff. The other ones wouldn't do it. So she's now 14, and she has. She's been worshiping her own deities for a long time.
When did you find out about the identities of the child? What age are the kids? You know, so that you can direct them the right way. What age would you? I suppose it's.
It depends on the kid. I mean, my youngest son's propensities were obvious by the time he was 7. I didn't particularly want to see them because they weren't the propensities that I wanted to have for my kid to have. Everybody else could see it. Everybody else said, oh, Keshav is a Vaishya. And I'm like, no, he's not. And he said, yeah, he is. And he's totally a Vaishya. I mean, he started his own business when he was 7. So we had a group with us. And he had got a business. My husband ran a computer business, and he had catalogs of office supplies. And Keshav went to my husband and said, you know, I'd like to sell pencils and notebooks to the students. So, of course, my husband had to actually place the order and pay for it. But then Keisha would set the prices and organize it and take the individual orders and collect the money. And then, you know, he would pay my husband and then he would get the whatever the profit was. I'm not sure how old he was when he started selling prasadam also. We used to have a showing of those...
Be nice.
We would start having showing of Mahabharata and Ramayana once a week for all the devotees. I mean, in those days, people didn't have, like, their own video machines or... And so we had one because we were in the Gurukul, so we had a screen and a video, so everybody would come to the school after the Sunday feast, and Keisha would take advantage of that to sell the prasadam. So he would squeeze fresh orange juice and then freeze it with toothpicks and give people orange juice popsicles, and this was all coming from himself. You know, he did that himself, and he sold all different things over the years. So now he's a very successful businessman. Well, not that he's not doing that anymore, but he was doing that for years. Yeah, he ran his own prasadam business for about 3 years. I don't know. My oldest son, unfortunately, was in ashrams for 5 years. So we didn't really have him with us from when he was 5 till he was 11. And then he started learning programming from his father. And that's what he does as a living. I mean, he also has a lot of ability for creative work. But when did we notice that? Around there, 11, 12, 13. I'd say his nature was probably pretty obvious by then. And my daughter, who's a dancer and a teacher, I mean, we started giving her dance classes when she was, I'm not sure, 6 or 7. But she was trying to dance long before that. You know, we have photographs of her at 2 and 3 trying to dance. And we gave her dance classes only because there was a member of the congregation who offered free dance classes at the temple, and it was there and it was free. That was, there was really nothing beyond that. And I don't think she really... I don't think that really blossomed again until she was about 12. So when she was little, it wasn't that obvious, but at 12. And, like, she's an artist, but that also... 12, 13. Her ability to be a teacher, maybe a little later. 14. But all of my kids would teach because we ran a school and the school was in their house and so on. But especially my 2 younger children are very good at that. I mean, my youngest son also made extra money being a tutor for quite a while.
A little bit about how the husband's role was in raising children and the mother's, like...
Well, gosh, that's so individual.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that is the individual person, and a lot of that are the cultural norms that are happening at the time. So, like, I see both my sons and my son-in-law are much more involved with raising their children than my husband was or my father was. You know, the only time my husband changed a nappy was when I threw up my back. But my sons and son-in-law regularly change nappies. I mean, and why? Because that's the culture has changed. The expectations have changed. I'd say it really depends. Depends on the individuals and the individuals involved. You know, everybody's going to have a really different situation. I don't want to put a, it should be this way or... It has to be this way.
Did you find about your kids being much more strong-headed, sort of much more individual, or you never had that experience? They say that, but I see them much, but it's probably just me.
I see that Devoni kids are much more philosophically astute at a young age.
Okay. But the age of two, do you see them a bit more strong-willed? And
well, most kids' will starts manifesting at about 13 months.
Okay.
In general, until about 12, 13 months, kids are pretty pliable. And you put them wherever you put them, and they do whatever, they may protest, but they're not really exhibiting their will. And somewhere around 13 months, kids start exhibiting their will. And, I'm not going to do this. And I'm not going to do what you want. And that's true in general.
What to do with this will and what age?
It's the main demarcation of being alive.
So how do we deal with it?
Cherish it.
When do we put boundaries?
Value it. Honor it.
I'm cherishing you.
What about me? Because I get often feedback that I'm too lenient and she will walk over me later on. So,
some of us are just more lenient and some of us are just more strict, and that's probably how we are. And whatever book you read and whatever course you take and whatever good advice other people give you probably aren't going to do the slightest bit of good. It's just like some of us are super organized and some of us are super creative, and it's just who we are and it's what we are. And whatever I am isn't what you are, and whatever you are isn't what I am, and that's okay. And we're individuals and it's fun.
Okay.
You know, and one thing you see after dealing with hundreds of kids is that the kids from the lenient parents and the kids from the strict parents and the kids from the parents in between pretty much all grow up to be normal, healthy, adjusted. And unless it's really extreme. Unless you have parents who are cruel or you have parents who are neglectful. But most people grow up to be normal, adjusted adults. Yeah. And you'll never be a perfect parent, forget it. You won't. And there'll be things that you'll look back at and go, oh my God, I can't believe I said that, or I can't believe I did that. Why did I do that? And it's just, it just is. Now, having said that, there's a really nice book called Parent Effectiveness Training, PET. Which talks about the liberal, strict dichotomy and continuum. And I'm not saying I agree with everything in the book or that it's Shasta or anything like that. But particularly on this topic of liberal and conservative, I really, really like the way that they explain it. They talk about method one, method two, and method three, and I'm probably getting one and two wrong. I can't remember which is which. It's been a long time since I read it. But one of them is the parent who's pretty much always strict. They always have rules, and you always have to follow the rules, and these are the consequences and the rules, and they're very consistent, but they're very strict. And then there's a parent who's very lenient. But they pointed out that parents who are lenient are rarely consistently lenient. That most parents who are lenient, 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 and then they explode. And they're lenient, 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 and then they explode. And that those tend to be the two main extremes that people go to. Either like, it's okay. Which means that the parent really isn't okay with everything and is just trying to falsely tolerate everything, and then everything builds up to the point that they're in explosion. And they were saying that when the parents are too strict, the kids will hate the parents, and when the parents are too lenient and they explode periodically, the parents will hate the kids.
And also kids might later blame the parents.
Well, some of your children will blame you later for something. Just deal with it.
Yeah.
Okay? For sure. For sure, your kids will blame you for something. And if you have a bunch of them, at least one of them will blame you for something. So, it just, that is what it is. And there's no use defending yourself. You just say, I'm really sorry. I wasn't a perfect parent. I hope you'll forgive me when you can go home. Because that's all they really want you to say anyway.
There's a muffin.
and the kid may blame you for doing what you thought was the best thing you did. You know, you may have a part of your parenting that you're really, really proud of, and you really put a lot of energy into, and you read all the books on it, and you practice, and you really put your heart and soul into it, and that'll be the thing that one of your kids doesn't like. And different kids are different, you know. One of your children will really like something that one of your children didn't like. And one of, you know, if you take your kids to a lot of different classes and you teach them a lot of different things, and one of your kids will say, "Oh, I'm so glad you taught me so many things." And the other kid will say, "Why did you drag me to so many classes?" And,
yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it is true. And just, that just is what it is. But the third, yeah, that would be nice. But the third way they talked about, which I thought was really nice, was that of negotiating. Rather than just either letting the kid do whatever they want or trying to force the kid to do whatever you want. You know, in one scenario, the kid is your slave, and the other scenario, you're the kid's slave. And neither of those are satisfying relationships. It's not really the kind of relationship we want with another living being. So that will not satisfy you, and it will not satisfy your kid. You know, it's really interesting for me. I had conflicts with my husband over other things, but never that. I didn't personally experience that. My husband and I agreed so much about how to raise our children that we never even talked about it.
I just can't.
We didn't even realize that we agreed, because we never even talked about it. We just naturally raised our kids the same way. But we disagreed about other things. But I have seen that in some families, that one of the major elements of discord is how they raise the children. My suggestion to you is, remember, there isn't one right way of raising children. There just isn't. I'm sorry. There isn't. You know, one parent who's a little stricter, one parent who's a little bit more lenient. The kids are going to turn out all right anyway. And they really will. And you never get it perfect. You won't get it perfect. No matter how many books you read and how many courses you take and how much you attend Hare Krishna, you're going to make mistakes. And you're going to do something that some of your kids don't like. And so why fight about it so much?
One of us has to walk away, otherwise it becomes too intense, the atmosphere, and the child doesn't know what to do.
But if it's not so important, why fight about it so much?
No, we don't fight. It just comes because he thinks one thing and I think something else, because our nature is quite different.
And maybe if you can help to tell yourself that it isn't so important. You know, it's what's more important? That you do it your way, or that there's peace in the house? See, if we're convinced that a certain way of raising children is going to ruin them or is going to be the best thing for them, then we'll get really upset about these things. But it just isn't true.
My husband said yesterday, I've got a similar problem, because I think if I let her, you know, just quiet. Strong-headed, and if I let her, I think, you know, I let her go on too much, then she will be worse. She's been having quite a bit heavy tantrums last week, and he said, "Oh, I don't want to be too strict with her because my parents were like that with me, and I remember I really was suffering because of it."
Well, that's also what's happening. If our parents were really lenient, we may become very strict. Like my parents were super lenient with me, so I tended to be very strict. And if your parents are very strict, then you think, "Oh, I want to be very lenient." I mean, look, do I sound like a strong-willed person to you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like every day very strong-willed.
My parents let me do whatever I wanted when I was a kid.
Oh, there you go.
So maybe it ruined me. I don't know. You'll have to decide. But I was very fortunate. Because my parents...
They trusted you, isn't it?
Well, first of all, they had no idea how to deal with me.
Oh,
So if they had tried to control me, they would have made a mess of it. So I'm really glad they just left me alone. I mean, in many ways, as I grew up, I wished that I had had more direction. And I wish that they had been stricter with me, especially when I was a teenager. I made some pretty bad mistakes as a teenager because they trusted me too much. But, I mean, it was fine them trusting me until I was about 10, and after that they shouldn't have trusted me so much. It was really sweet.
Until about 12?
They probably should have had more restrictions on me from the time I was very small. Because once they realized that they should restrict me, it was too late. There was no way I was going to have so much freedom, and then all of a sudden at like 14, be told what to do. It wouldn't work. You know.
Yeah, 14 at that time is too late.
It's too late.
You're already your own person. Nobody can say anything.
Yes. If they had set up a system before that where they were more in control, but they didn't, and so it. And it was something, I got into trouble. I made some really stupid decisions. So, but on the other hand, what do I have? Okay, I have a high level of confidence. I have a high level of courage. I had a really nice relationship of love and trust with my parents. And because my father trusted me so much, anything he said I would do. You know, my father wouldn't have had to have been strict. If he would have just said, hey, I really don't know if you should go hang out with those people, I wouldn't have hung out with them. That was all that would be needed, but he didn't do that, unfortunately. But, I mean, not my mother, but my father and I had gotten such a deep level of friendship and trust. I mean, my father yelled at me twice in my life. This is going to be a very interesting recording for those of you listening to the recording.
Is there a consistent method, or does it depend on the child? I mean, what child goes with it, or, you know,
I think you better sit down.
Be nice. Go it. Be nice. And you make, you know, you can do that.
Yeah.
Be nice. No hitting.
What if I go like that?
Do that to go far.
Be nice. Be nice. The main thing I see with discipline is consistency. Okay. So what I see is that there's always a price. There's always a sacrifice. So perhaps one of the most difficult things for parents to do is consistency. But if it's consistent, the price you pay is you've got to notice when things are wrong and you've got to respond to them right away. And if you notice when things are wrong and you respond to them right away, they're not going to go on for very long. But to do that, you have to pay the price of being observant, and you've got to pay the price of responding to them right away over and over again, which is tiring. Oh, I already responded to this 3 times. I don't feel like responding to it right now. I'm just going to let it go now. But if you're not consistent, then you pay the sacrifice of dealing with things for a long, long, long time. And just, it's good to understand something about human psychology in this regard.
Yes.
So do you know one reason why people like to gamble? You know, one of the appeals of gambling is that you don't know when you're going to win. So if you decided at a slot machine and you put in, you know, a pound, and every time you put in a pound, you pulled the handle and you got out 2 pounds, you would get bored. People would not earn their living by doing that. That's not the appeal, is that it's a surprise. That you don't know whether you're going to lose your money or you're going to get more money. It's random rewards. Random rewards are much more reinforcing than consistent rewards. And you notice that Krishna randomly rewards us, by the way, in our devotional service. It's not like every time you pick up your japa beads, you're going to get ecstasy. You might not. You don't know. Is it going to happen today or is it not going to happen today? And how is it going to happen? But that's the way a living being is wired. So if you occasionally let your children get away with something you don't want them to get away with, you're reinforcing that behavior much more strongly than if you let them get away with it consistently. The same with whining. You know, if you ever give in to whining, you're actually reinforcing the behavior more than if you give in to it all the time. Because then it's exciting.
Can I get away with it?
And then you're training them also to have a very, very long whining time. Because I just don't know. You know, sometimes if I whine for 2 hours, I get what I want. And therefore, you're actually training them to whine for 2 hours. Whereas if you consistently don't give in to whining, they'll stop. So, but either way, there's something you have to tolerate. You know, either you have to tolerate the ongoing bad behavior, or you have to tolerate being on top of it consistently. And it can take a while to train something. The point is, you can't get away from sacrifice, and you've got to decide which sacrifice you want. It's like keeping a clean house. Do you want the sacrifice of cleaning your house, or do you want the sacrifice of living in a messy house? And I don't see that it's less or more work one way or the other. It's or less or more mental suffering. It's just different. And frankly, some people are going to be more comfortable with one thing over the other. So I can say to you that I think you'll be happier if you consistently deal with bad behavior firmly and quickly. But that's my taste. And that's something I've had to recognize over the years. You know, at first I just thought these people who tolerate bad behavior from their kids are really foolish. And then I saw that, oh, they're just choosing a different yajna than I'm choosing. Yeah.
But they do say to nip it in the bud.
They say. Depends who they is. Depends which they. You can always find a they who will say something else. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, you can always find an expert who will say something else. And remember that these things change culturally. So what's the obvious cultural wisdom at one time is not the obvious cultural wisdom 10 years later. You're not looking at some sort of truth when you're looking at these things. You're looking at different cultural biases about what is and is not good child raising, and what is and is not good relationships. And then you're looking at the opinion, the experience of those particular people. And please keep that in mind. So certain things that certain people say will resonate with you, and certain things won't. You know, again, for me, I would much rather be consistent and nip things in the bud and be on top of it, and then it's over. Even if it means I have to work hard for a while and I have to be observant. I'd rather take that yajna than deal with a kid that's going on and on for years and years and years having this problem. But not everybody is like me. And some people would much, much rather that they don't have to be so observant, and they don't have to be so on top of it, and they don't have to get out of their chair, and they don't have to walk over the kid, and they'd rather just wait till there are extreme cases and deal with those occasionally, and let the mild cases go on. And in both cases, the kids generally will be all right. You're probably not going to get a serial killer either way. you know. So it's you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And frankly, if you try to do something that's not who you are, you won't do it. And then all you do is feel guilty that you're not doing it, and you'll feel like you're a bad parent that you're not doing it. Do you understand that? Do you understand that? Okay, let's say you read a book where they say, you know, most of the time, just let the kids do whatever they want. Only interested in doing something really serious. Eventually, it'll go away by itself. But you're the kind of person who's a very structured, on top of it, consistent, orderly person. And you try to do that system, and you can't. Because it's driving you bananas. And then you think, oh, I'm a bad mother. I'm too strict because I'm not following the system. Or you read a book that says you should nip it in the bud and you should be on top of it. And as soon as they do something wrong, you should do this. And you should. But you're a very laid back, go with the flow, flexible, whatever comes to me is cool kind of person. And you can't do that. You're not willing to jump up out of your chair and say something every 5 minutes for a week. You're just not willing to do that. And so you don't do it. And then you think, oh, I'm a bad mother because I'm not strict enough with my kids. So why don't you just be who you are? Okay, well, pick what you want to discipline. Don't try to discipline them for everything. Remember that some things are going to go away just by growing up. You know, it's not that you have to train everything. And if you try to train a child in everything at once, you'll just confuse them anyway and drive yourself totally nuts. So decide, you know, what's important. And don't focus on too many things at a time. Personally, I think hitting is important and biting is important. I mean,
yeah.
Some people don't. Okay, I don't relate to that. But some people don't. They just don't. Now, generally, that will also go away. We don't go around hitting and biting other people. So I assume that no matter how our parents trained us, it went away. So you might decide, well, I'm just going to wait till that goes away. But if you want it, whatever you want to do, you want to notice it as soon as it happens in the smallest manifestation as possible and do something to stop it and to communicate to the child that it's not good. And to preferably show them what you want them to do instead.
Do you believe in timeouts at all?
Sure. Prabhupada talks about that a lot.
Who?
Prabhupada talks about, you know.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. He talks about how it's not a permanent solution. How to take a few hours. Well, Mother Yashoda did a timeout. What do you think she did when she tied up Krishna? That was what it was. It was a timeout. So now we have like playpens or something.
No teacher.
Yeah. We don't tie them someplace. But if you put them in a playpen, it's the same principle that you're restricting their movement and something.
Oh, yeah, that's the thing. She goes in such a rage that I have to like maybe make like a very safe corner because she just hits everything.
Oh, yeah, well, then I would take them, put them in another place and just ignore them until it's over. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to give them positive or negative response to that.
Definitely. That's very lovely point. I've actually never read it or heard it anywhere, isn't it? That go with your nature mainly, isn't it? It's very nice.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is just what I see practically. I see that people frustrate themselves so much. By trying to do something that's not who they are.
Yeah. No, it's very logical.
It just doesn't work. Oh, it migrated. Have I bored everybody?
No, I think they just don't want to disturb you because they just...
I'm not disturbed.
Sorry, this one's
I think we taught, isn't it, in a class, they can't make a noise.
Not in this class, they can make as much noise as they want. Anyway, I just see practically. I see that if you give somebody a method that's not in accord with their nature and who they are, they will not do it.
Yeah, that's very true.
And then the consequences of that are they will feel guilty. Yeah. They'll feel like they're a bad parent.
Yeah.
They'll try to do it, and they'll do it poorly and inconsistently, and therefore they'll just make a whole muck of the whole thing.
Big
mess. And better to just find a method that is who you are and be happy with who you are.
Yeah.
And don't look at some other mother and say, well, I've got to do it that way.
Yeah.
And also, you know, if the parents disagree, you know, your husband's allowed to be his child. And children have two parents for a reason. You know, God, I mean, Krishna could have arranged that the children had only one parent. And he arranged that the children have two parents. You know, you already have the difference, the male-female difference. And then you also have...
Sorry.
That's fun. I like kids. It's okay.
She's cute.
Can I take a picture?
She's blowing in,
oh, that's so cute.
She's blowing in my ear.
Whispering.
Are you whispering in my ear? And there's benefit. I'm so glad I had a mother and a father. There's certain things like there's some people don't, you know, and I'm so glad I had a mother and father. I got certain things from my mother and certain things from my father. And I'm very glad that neither of my parents forced the other parent to parent like them. You know, they each had their own parenting styles, and I'd say overall my father was a better parent, but he had a weakness in his parenting style too. Which my mother counterbalanced to some extent. This idea that I have to, you know, I have to be like this other mother, or I have to make my husband be like me. I mean, unless you're talking about extremes. If you're talking about somebody who's actually abusing a child or neglecting them or something like that.
Is there another principle in which, because you have various different parenting styles, any like consistency is an important principle, any other principle that would be universal for everyone?
Recognize it, honor and celebrate your child's will and their personality and their tendencies and their natures, and realize that some of the child's natures may be the things that annoy you the most when you're little. Because those are the things that the child particularly likes to do. So if there's something that a child does a lot, even if it's annoying, it may be indicative of some kind of strength or talent in them. Sorry about that.
I've just had a question that's been texted through, how to engage boys with a lot of energy.
Or girls.
Or girls. Girls have a lot of energy.
Obvious.
Well, there's always the great outside. I remember I was once watching some people's boys, three boys, while they were in India for 7 weeks.
Oh.
But we had lots of kids living in our house over the years. But when they would start running around in the house, I told them to run around the house.
That's a good point.
You know, they were running. We had, I guess, 2 floors. And they were running up and down the stairs.
Oh, God.
I said, go outside and run around the house, and you don't want to run around anymore, and then you can come back in.
Do you think that?
And then there's sports, and I mean, you're talking about very young children, right?
Yeah, young children like 2 years old, and they're just going outside, yeah?
Little farm.
Unless it's pouring, which it does here a lot.
Yeah,
that's the biggest
problem in this country.
Yeah. Exercises.
Do you think, just as your, because it's a PhD in psychology.
My PhD is in education.
Education.
Education and leadership, actually.
Just as an observation, do you recall having lots of ADHD children, like, when you were growing up?
No.
Because do you think that's just something that, as a society, people develop because they don't let their kids run around because of all the health and safety and...
Probably, and because of excessive television watching and...
Yeah.
Dyes and chemicals in the food, and also a lot of kids who are labeled as ADHD are simply highly creative
children,
lateral thinking children. I mean, like I have of my grandchildren. One of my grandchildren is hyper focused. He can focus on anything and not notice anything around him. at all, which is good and bad. You know, if someone else needs some help or something else, he doesn't see it. He's just, whatever he's doing, you know, he's completely focused. And then his younger brother is exactly the opposite. He has almost no focus ability at all. He's aware of everything that everybody's doing in the household and probably the rest of the family. You know, he's just, and he has a very, very hard time putting his attention on what he's supposed to be doing. He's noticing what everybody else is supposed to be doing.
How old is he?
He's now 13.
Is this yours?
The older, other one's 14. The other one's 14. But isn't that what managers have to do? Don't managers have to notice what hundreds of people are doing?
Yay!
So is he ADHD or is he a manager? Mm. You know, what are you looking at? Are you looking at it as a disability or that it's... both of those things could be disabilities depending on how you look at them. You know, and both of them can be strength depending on how... Depends what you're doing with it. If you want someone to be a scientific researcher working alone in a laboratory at 11 o'clock at night, you know, or you want somebody managing a business of 10,000 employees. So I think a lot of what's called ADHD is putting everybody in the same kind of school and expecting everybody to sit down and just do, you know, what one researcher called clerical work.
Mm.
You know, everyone's just doing...
labeling, isn't it?
Yeah. Work that for a lot of people is going to be boring, and they're not going to want to focus on it.
Mm.
You know, John Audubon, who did the whole bird thing, he spent his school time looking out the window at the birds. So, you know, he probably would have been labeled attention deficit disorder. And you all know Amal Harinam, who leads kirtans?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a wild child.
He's so calm.
Well, that's because he's doing something with his energy now. But until he was 12. And the devotees would come to me and say, can't you calm him down? And I'd say, no, leave him alone. I'd say, wait until he gets to be 12. All right, well, you guys seem like you're going.
Oh, no, it's the baby's.
Now I'm ready.